Feminism and family ties. Sisterhood is global. Parenting is a partnership, and family reunions are required. This is liberation. And that's kind of the outline of what we'll be talking about tonight. So it may not have been exactly what you were expecting when we talked about feminism and family ties. I was interested the other night when someone in one of the forums made the comment that sometimes they feel that feminism leads to divorce. I would like to take some time and discuss that sometime, because I think that if it does, there may be reasons for it that are not laid at the fault of feminism, but rather what the issues are involved. But to repeat, as I have each time when I've started, I will begin the session with my own philosophy of feminism, which I'd written a few years back, and kind of expresses the context in which we'll be talking about this. I am one and you another. I am sister, you are brother. Woman, man, God created, human beings, loved, related, both alive, each unique, both are strong, each is weak, person, human, celebrated, all God's children, liberated. And it is in that spirit of liberation for all of us that I couch my feminism and the discussions that will be continuing the rest of this week. One of the new books that I am going to begin tonight with sharing a little bit from is Bärbel von Wartenberg Potter. I think that's how you say that. B-A-R-B-E-L with two dots over the A, Bärbel. Anybody know? Anyway, the book is We Will Not Hang Our Harps on the Willows, and it's about global sisterhood and God's song. And her title comes from a psalm, Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon we sat down. There we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows nearby we hung up our harps. Those who captured us told us to sing. They told us to entertain them. Sing a song about Zion. How can we sing a song to the Lord in a foreign land? So we will not hang our harps on the willows. It's a very helpful book to me. I even listed it, although I haven't even quite finished reading it yet, as one of my favorite books when was it Linda that comes around and Karen that comes around and asks about staff people's favorite books? And I when I pick it up, it's hard to set down because it's full of all kinds of things. And maybe because this week I've been so immersed in this subject that it speaks to my needs right now. It's a book of hope, the gift of hope for women struggling, women suffering, and women yearning for justice. One of the things that has been said about the feminist movement in the United States is that it has sometimes been a white middle class women's movement, and that unless we are concerned about our sisters around the world, it's not a movement that's worth anything. Bärbel does not forget the sisters from the third world. She doesn't silence their criticisms of our feminism. Sometimes our struggles appear to them as a luxury of those who are not forced to fight the greater enemy that threatens the lives of their children through starvation and never-ending militarization. And I think that that's what we'll be talking a little bit about tonight, some of our sisters around the world whose struggles have been far different from ours and who think that we are having the luxury of discussing these issues when they're concerned about their kids and enough to eat. So she opens the eyes in this book, and that's why it's been meaningful to me. She opens the eyes of middle-class feminists for thinking globally and acting locally. And I think that's one of the challenges, that thinking globally and acting locally, because not all of us are going to be able to go out and take care of things around the world. But we can't forget to think about that and to become informed and to become conscious of it and to dialogue with our sisters whose struggles are different, because in truth, all struggles for liberation are related to each other. She has a section in here that I'm just dying to discuss with Byron. We'll probably get into this on the way home. It's called Confronting the Good, and she talks about courageous confrontation. I remember once, long time ago, when we were living in Princeton and not having, being graduate students with no money at all, we were dependent on the wealthy people in Princeton who didn't use their theater tickets at night and would post them up on the bulletin board. And we happened to get tickets one night for Virginia Woolf. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I remember at the intermission, going out, and we were, you know how Virginia Woolf was talking about the evil in people, and I was convinced, because I had a mother who was just like a saint, that there were people that were born with good inside, but I guess that's not an altogether Lutheran doctrine or theology. So we've gone around in circles about this idea of original sin and all being totally sinners and not being able to find the good inside of people or whatever. Anyway, it's been a constant struggle with us in terms of that confrontation. And so I was really nurtured by this Barville's writing when she talked about a woman who had helped her look at the Bible in different ways. And I could relate to Barville is a Lutheran pastor from Germany, and so I could relate to it because she came out of the same kind of background as we all, or many of us, have. And she said that Suzanne de Dietrich, a small, crippled, pioneering woman of the ecumenical movement from Alsace, had traveled all over the world on crutches trying to help people see new ways of reading the Bible, and had talked about this courageous confrontation. She goes on to say, on one hand, there's the confrontation with evil. And most of us who have grown up in the Lutheran Church, how many of the people here tonight have some familiarity with Lutheran theology or something? Looks like a lot of us. And you are?
Reformed background, now Baptist.
Uh-huh. So you might have some familiarity from a little bit. Okay. Anyway. We're pretty familiar with this confrontation of evil, with racism, sexism, stupidity, heartlessness, brutality, greed, militarism, selfishness, pride, self-opinionatedness, and despair, and so forth. Courageous confrontation with evil inside of me or around me is something I've been practicing for years, since, after all, ever since my childhood, we've been learning that we are all sinners. And what is more difficult is confrontation with what is good, whether in myself or others. Imagine yourself saying to a concentration camp guard or to an advocate of apartheid or a protagonist of the arms race or a rapist, "Look, you are good. God has given you a heart. Rouse it. It's asleep. Trust yourself. There's much potential good in you. God has freed, redeemed you, given you a new chance. Come out of yourself. Look after yourself. You are crippled in the cellar of the house of your life without light. Open the window. Bring yourself to light, God's light, human light. Water the plants of your humanness, your divine likeness. Believe in me. It is all there inside of you. And that's what she says courageous confrontation is, or could look like. And then she goes on to say that you could say that not just to the sinful people that you meet around yourself, but also to yourself. Occasionally, when you feel self-hate and depression and angry, allow yourself to be told that you are good. When lust for revenge comes over you, or you feel like pursuing at all costs legitimate self-interests, then remind yourself that you are good. Such courageous, not that what you're doing is good, but that you are good. Such courageous confrontation with goodness is much more difficult and is hardly ever practiced. After all, we know better. We are evil, and the others are even worse, she says. Some of that is apparent in a lot of the current psychology and a lot of the current movements, where people are saying that, kind of going overboard without this confrontation of evil and good, but are going overboard and thinking of everything as good and not having that balance. As Phyllis says to us often in the mornings when we go out and stretch, we need the balance. Not we're all evil, or not everything's good, but a confrontation, a courageous confrontation between good and evil. And so she goes on to say that the God-given sparks with inside of us are what's exciting and what's good, and she wants to entice us toward that goodness. And let the human being that is within us come out of our prison of inhumanity, and so that God can confront us with the potential implanted inside of our own heart. Love of our neighbor, love of our enemies, and justice. That's what Jesus made whole. And so she also goes on to say that for this kind of confrontation, we need community. We need help with it. We might not be able to do that alone. And so then she was in a situation where there was a great deal of pain in her own life. Her two children died, one at birth and one at, I think, about 5 years or maybe less. But anyways, very small. And then after that happened, her marriage broke up. They were able to bury their children and to receive hope in that situation somehow, but they were not able to bury the differences that had come between them, and so they divorced. So she was really in a desperate situation herself, and came to discover, as she traveled around the world, probably on her own search for who she was. She said she had grown up in the church, in a men's church, among the fathers and the brothers, the brethren, and in so many places. She had realized that as she grew and searched, that the occupation forces in my head were being pushed back. They retreated in the face of the developing power of my own independent thinking as a woman. So it was after those tragedies in her life that she was able to start branching out. And it became the idea of the injustice and for women began to outrage and occupy her thinking. But then she said, I should like to make here a declaration of confidence in support of global sisterhood, a credo for the communario sanctarum. Who's taken Latin around here, any of you?
Holy Communion.
Pardon me?
Holy Communion.
Yeah, the Communion of Saints. But she said she had to even prune the Latin of sexist language, so that's why she called it communio sanctarum. I guess that's not the masculine ending of it. In this case, the communion of saints, of the women that she learned to know as she traveled around. She said, "I have learned to respect my sisters, to love them, and to expect great things from them." And then she lists a group of women who have become really important to her and who have become shining lights in terms of how much she has begun to see the strength and the weakness and the beauty and the uniqueness of each of these people. And so I was thinking it'd be kind of fun to have each one of you think. She talks about the women in Rio, the theologians who celebrated Catholic Protestant communion together and who were reprimanded from the top because the celebrant had been a woman. And she talks about, she lists a whole bunch of people that her sisters that she has learned to respect and to love. And I was thinking of some people that I've come to appreciate and either through books or through personal experience, like Carter Haywood, the book that I just read recently, who was one of the 11 Episcopalian women who forged ahead and were eventually ordained, and Geraldine Ferraro, who took some risks, and Corazon Aquino, and Abelina Gomez, the wife of Medardo Gomez, the Bishop of El Salvador, and Elvia Alvarado, who we'll be talking about. I'd like to have each one of you name somebody that stands out in your mind, some woman who has done something that you have really respected, and maybe just say the name and maybe just say one little bit about what that woman, that sister, either locally or globally, somebody that you know through personally or through the news. How about coming up in the middle row, in the front row? We don't have any back rows here. Thanks. Who wants to start? Mentioning, okay.
Well, an obvious, easy one for me is Teresa, Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa, okay. Who has?
Just her ministry of to the poor and the downtrodden.
Okay.
It's just been mightily impressive to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting back in touch with the woman whose name is Septima Poinsettia Clark, who was a real strong woman figure in the civil rights movement. Was a teacher on the Outlying Islands in South Carolina, and then became a part of the Highlander School in Tennessee, and was a pioneer in the citizenship schools.
Huh. Septima Poinsettia
Clark. Her family was, during the slavery period, was owned by a plantation owner whose name was Poinsettia. For whom the Poinsettia was, he developed the Poinsettia. I think that's a wonderful name.
Yeah, and a wonderful thing she did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Civil rights, I think, Rosa Parks.
Rosa Parks.
Down on the bus.
That's right. And you know, we had a woman in our at the University, California Lutheran University, whose name was Rosa Weeks. And I, for the whole first year that she was there, I kept going up to her and saying, "Hi, Rosa Parks," because it just came to me. But she's she was another inspiration. Like she said, she was always honored to be called that. Surely you can think of some women.
I don't know how many of you would know the name Marjorie Bly, who's a missionary in the Taiwan area that worked in the leprosy colonies for many, well, essentially all of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Marvelous.
We gave her an honorary degree one
time. Oh, did we at CLU? Hmm.
Won't mean anything to anybody, but Marie Schilling, who has retired from a school principal's job in very early and has moved to inner city Philadelphia to form or to start a private school for underprivileged kids.
Wow.
Yeah, no kidding.
So it means something to all of us because she's a model, even though you had to tell us her name. Right. That's great. Thank you.
Another name you won't know, Pat Obrecht, our local woman who in Schenectady, New York, has organized food bank, food pantry, and has extended things such as having the League of Women Voters come and register people for voting, and getting involved with the Hispanic community in our town. So.
Great. Come on, you know somebody I know.
Well, I know, I think of Amelia Earhart, I guess, the aviatrix, I guess you'd call her.
Mm-hmm.
And also Madame Curie comes to mind.
Right. Okay.
Two people that won't mean anything to you either, but they're on my past. One of them is a lady named Melvin Glazier, who introduced women's studies at the university I was at in the 60s.
Oh.
And back then that was a very progressive thing to do.
Uh-huh.
And another lady more recently would be Dr. Marjorie Whitaker at Oregon State, who is in charge of, who's dean of home economics, that has done a lot to encourage people in growth.
Cut the sparks and help them come out.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just two people.
Great, Bonnie, thanks.
The person that won't mean probably too much to a Wealthy Fisher. She started the Literacy Village in China many years ago.
Started a what?
Literacy Village.
Oh.
It became a college, and then they trained their own people to take it over. That was her goal. The people of the country would be their own teachers.
And able to read their own language. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
A colleague of ours at CLU is Marge Wolf. We're probably all heard of her, but she's such a quiet, compassionate woman, but she's so powerful and so such a pioneer in this whole area. She's just an inspiration.
Well, thank you. It's kind of exciting to think about. And to celebrate the histories of women. When I was taking women's history this last semester, I was amazed at how many strong and wonderful women there were in our history that we'd never even heard about. So it's important to keep sharing these stories and telling each other about people that we know until those names too become familiar. And not all of them will be worldwide familiar, but to celebrate them as we go. You know, there are so many of them. Communio Sanctarum, as varied as the earth circle itself. Yet they are able to discover, however painfully slowly, the things they hold in common. In the very struggle, it is clear that they have heart and wounds, and that they are angry and determined to discover something new, something better than we have at present. And so the struggle goes on. When we talk about global sisterhood, the question often comes up, what part do men play if what we are aiming for is global sisterhood? Both you and I, she's writing a letter, this part of this chapter of the book, she's writing a letter to Elsa, who is a friend of hers in Central America, and they are struggling with these issues back and forth about global sisterhood, and since she is a woman of Central America, she has confronted Bearville with the idea of, you know, what this feminist issue is all about, and they're struggling with that whole process of, is it a luxury for your side of feminism here in America in the middle class, is that a luxury? And she says, and then what about the men? Both you and I, Elsa, love and live with a man, and we do not shirk the difficulty of applying the views of the women's movement in many small, sometimes even mean details of our daily lives. It is the price we pay, and pay willingly, in order to find a better alternative to the disintegrated relationship between many partners. I do not share the view of some of our sisters in the women's movement that women are better human beings. I know myself too well for that. I believe that the advancement of women is an advancement for the whole of humanity. That is why I still insist that women have to make their own analysis of the situation, that we have to join forces and with determination deliberately set about putting an end to patriarchal authoritarianism in order to make way for something that does more justice to all concerned. And we do it for men's sake as well as for our own. So this, it's kind of been an exciting growth pattern to play. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the liberation stories. You've mentioned women who have done some of these things that have been important to others in your life or in the life of their country. And I'm going to talk just a little bit right now about two women in Central America. One whom I was able to meet, and one whom I have to not lose this page. And one whom I don't know but feel like I know, because she, in a sense, is a symbol of many of the women in Central America. This book is called Don't Be Afraid, Gringo, A Honduran Woman Speaks from the Heart. And she, we saw the slide picture show of her story. And so I felt like I kind of met her on screen, it's an amazing story. She was a peasant woman who talked about her childhood. She was one of several children who lived in a little town in Honduras. And when she was about 6 years old, her father left, and the mother struggled to raise the other children for a while, and then found a husband, but he would not accept the children. So the mother left the children with the grandmother and went to live with the husband. And she seemed to say that was typical of many of the campesino families, that when the family split up, there was a kind of a larger extended family that took care of the children, and the relationships were a large family of, you know, kind of an expanded family. But anyway, she said that then when her mother left to go live with this other person, she began to live with her brother, and she, after a couple of years, had a boyfriend. And she said they went out into the field and they did things that boys and girls do, but they didn't know what they were doing. They just were doing them. And she became pregnant. And her brother, whom she was living with at the time, got so angry that he told her she had to leave or he would kill her. She went to her sister, her older sister, and her sister said, your brother is so angry, I think you better get out of here. So she sent her off to the city. So here was this young girl of 15, 3 months pregnant, with a little sack of two dresses and no money, except that her sister paid her bus ticket to the city. And off she went to the city, and she got there and she sat in a park and didn't know what to do. She had no money, no place to live. She sat there and cried and cried and cried, and there was this night watchman that came up to her, and she said, "Oh, I'm just resting," and she wouldn't tell him, and he knew. And he finally got out of her that she didn't have any place to go, and she said, "Could I please sleep on the park bench tonight?" And he said yes, he would let her do that. And then in the morning he gave her one limpera for a cup of coffee and a piece of bread, and she went out to look for a job. And he said, "I don't think you should come back to the park because the other watch person, the other guard in the park was not like me, and he might not let you stay here." So she went out and looked for a job, but she couldn't find one, so she came back again and slept a second night in the park, and then finally found a job working for someone in their home as a maid. Until the woman said, "You can stay there till your baby is born." And so she stayed for 8 or 9 months. And then she had no choice but to take the baby and go back to the little village where she was from. And lived with, evidently with the one sister that had been kind to her. And then she got pregnant again. She said, "You know, in those days we didn't know, I really didn't know anything about there was any way in the church, and people said that's what women were for." So she had another baby, and the husband, the father of the baby didn't live with her, and then she had a third, and the father didn't live with her. And she was more or less going through this typical campesino pattern, which she says is kind of like what it was for the women in their village, and worked really hard getting any kind of odd job she could in order to just make enough money so that she could, her children could have at least rice and beans every day. And she worked at all kinds of odd jobs and did whatever she could and continued to work. And the fathers of her children would be gone, and they wouldn't send money or do anything to help support that. So, and she said that was really typical in the campesino village for many of the young women. And then finally she said she started living with this one guy. His name was Alberto. She said it was... she started going to church, I guess, and she met Alberto at church, and they started living together. But she said, "I had to leave my children with my mother because Alberto didn't want to have other men's children in his house." And so she lived with him, and she ended up living with him for 18 years. And about 15 years after this, you know, she'd been living with him, and they'd had a hand-to-mouth existence, and all they had been able to do with this little plot of land that they had was, it was just around their house, and they just had a little tiny garden. And then they go to church, and she said all of a sudden she began to work with the Mother's Club in the Catholic Church. And she said the Catholic Church had this idea that they could organize Mother's Clubs around the country. And so she said that they distributed food. The Mothers Clubs got together and they distributed food to the malnourished children, and they talked about growing gardens, and they gave talks on food and nutrition. And she said that began to become the highlight of the week, that going to this Mothers Club at church. And then she said Alberto didn't like it because I was so busy doing that it wasn't as easy for me to get all the things done that he thought I should be doing around the house. But she said she just kept going to the meetings and became very active and was eventually elected president. And she said then the church wanted to call together about 15 women that were active in these mothers' clubs and train them to go around and be organizers of mothers' clubs in other rural parishes. And she was one of the persons chosen to go to that. Well, Alberto really hit the roof then when she said she was going away for a week and just by herself to learn how to be organizing. He wanted her to stay at home, and he wanted her to take care of the kids. He said, "Who's going to take care of the kids?" She had three more kids with him, and they were living with him. And she said, Elvia said, well, you could take care of them. And all of this time he had been having difficulty finding work and had been frustrated and had spent most of his money on drink and would come home drunk at night. And so she was I think she was finding in the church that warmth and companionship that she wasn't finding at home. But then she said, the church wanted us to give out food to malnourished children, but they didn't want us to question why they were malnourished to begin with. So she wasn't totally, she was beginning to have some seeds of wonderment inside of her about whether this was the right process. But she went to this training session, got trained to be an organizer. She says later in the book that Jesus was an organizer too, and gave some examples about that. So the basis of her action grew out of the church. And then she was chosen to be one of the five out of those 15 that were to go around the country. Well, then she came home and told Alberto that she was going to be gone for a whole month and organize these. And then he really had a problem. But she said, and he told her she couldn't go. And but she said she was going to go anyway, and she did. And I guess he must have taken care of the children. I wonder what happened, but she went. And then, it's interesting, she said, he didn't want her to do that because he thought she was going out sleeping with all the other campesinos. And he couldn't fathom the idea that she was going out helping the women and that she wasn't having other men around. So she said, finally, I got fed up and I said to him, I'm sorry. I've been living with you for 18 years and I really don't want to lose you. I don't want my children to grow up without a father. But you're making life impossible for me. I'm not going to stop my work because I'm convinced that we Hondurans must do something for this country. And if you can't accept that, then you'll just have to leave. But he wouldn't leave. So finally she said, Calabaza, calabaza, and some more Spanish words, which means, you go your way and I'll go mine. So I took the children and moved out of the house. For years, we moved from place to place, living with friends and relatives. It was very hard for the kids. But last year, we finally got our own house. After so many years of floating around, it's like heaven to have a place of your own. I can't say I enjoy being single. I must admit I get the desire to be with a man. Elvia, my friend said to me, it's not good for you to be without a man for so many years. It's not right to deny your body that pleasure, and I'm no spring chicken. But when I get dressed up to go out, I still look pretty good. Good enough for the men to come after me, but I've taken a hard look at my life. I've looked at the relationships I've had with men. And I realized that I could never again live with a man who didn't share my values, who didn't have the same Christian principles, who didn't have the same devotion to the campesino struggle. The struggle is my life, and I could only share my bed with a man who shared the other parts of my life as well. Many of the men who are involved in the struggle still want their wives to stay home. They don't want their women to be active. So I've got a tall order to fill, to find a man who's not only sensitive to the campesino struggle, but to the women's struggle as well. And I think that's where many of the third world women find themselves. She went on to say that later in, and she kept on being active and really became an organizer. She said that the Catholic Church eventually dropped out of this program and they didn't support and pay for the women going around and doing that anymore because the women began not only to feed the malnourished children and empower other women to feed that, but they began to ask for the root causes of the problem. And that the church couldn't accept, that they were going to, you know, become a little bit more what she calls revolutionary here. So they decided to go on without the church. She said she still is a member or is a believer, but not in the same way. because she said that when you just give people food and don't help them change the problems, that it isn't the whole story. There's a wonderful chapter in here on her talk about liberation theology and how she has grown to encompass that in terms of how she looks at the Bible. So then she was asked in her work to with this group of organized women that were trying to make things, improve the conditions for campesinos and try to get them some land, and she got involved too in the land reform issue. And she was asked to deliver a letter to some people in the Maya Hotel in Tegucigalpa. And she said, I was afraid to go in there because I was afraid I'd never seen anything like that. In fact, she hadn't until just later in her life even been in the city. But she said, I was afraid to go into that hotel because I thought I'd be kicked out. But I got the bravery to do that. And she said, I could not believe my eyes. There were all of these well-fed blonde people, or people of my own race that were dressed like these well-fed blonde people. And she said, their children were playing in the pool. And she said, how I wished that my grandchildren would have a chance to play in a pool. She said, these children were so full of life and energy, just talking happily to each other. And she thought back on her children and grandchildren in the villages, how they were lethargic and unable to do as many things. And she said, it wasn't that we're dumb or that we're unable. She said, it's that we haven't had the education and the food, the diet, to have that kind of energy within us. And she said, I think it's too late for my generation and for my children, but it's not too late for my grandchildren, and I'm going to work. So Elvia Alvarado is a Honduran woman who speaks from the heart. I think of the woman who we visited outside of Cuernavaca in Mexico, whose name was Onesima. And she too had a similar story in terms of her the sad place where they lived, that it was extremely small, kind of a compound that they had there, and the men that her husband and the people in her family farmed away from their compound where they lived. In the compound, you walked through a little gate, and then when you went inside, it was like a square or a rectangle, and around the edges of it were little rooms and buildings, and then in the middle was kind of like a garden plot. In one of the rooms was an outdoor kitchen. It was just covered with a thatched roof and had a dirt floor, and there was a refrigerator and a table, and then there was an oven kind of thing. And they had some benches there, and they let us sit down. But when we were looking around, our eyes were casting around the yard, and there were chickens, and there was an old beat up hand pump well, and some farm machinery, just small pieces of hand farm machinery that looked like it was in need of repair. And there was a room that looked kind of like a garage, and it had a door in front of it that was like a cage, and there was a woman in there that looked like she was about 20 years old. And we asked about that, and they said that it was their daughter who was retarded from birth, and they used to just, you know, let her be, and she would get out of the compound and get raped and come home and be pregnant and have another child. And she said, the mother said that they couldn't keep on having more mouths to feed, and they couldn't keep their daughter home when they didn't have her barricaded, so they had to put her in this little garage. There was no mental institution to which she could be sent for help. There were no doctors that could give her help. And I think about that woman and how her hand was coming out through the bars and she was calling us to come and talk to her. And I was thinking about the pain that she must feel being locked up in her own yard. And it became for me a metaphor of how so many women are locked up in their own situations. And then I thought too of the pain of the mother wanting that daughter to have a real life and not being able to trust or have help and support in order to let her get better. So that was a sad situation. The men were sitting there telling us about their farming and how they were very dependent on the rain because they didn't have irrigation, and so if there was good rainy weather, then they might have a good crop, and if not, there was just terribly, terribly destitute. And they said that the cutting down of the forests around them had meant that they don't have as much rain there anymore. So it just seemed like such a bleak situation, and so I was thinking about that while we were sitting there talking to them and listening to their story, and I wrote this poem that I will share with you, which tells of another of our sisters, yours and my sister. Her name was Onesima. Brown as earth, smooth and cracked by the relentless slaughter of sun and wind on once soft skin. Strong, sad, resolute face, tied to work-worn shoulders by thick black braids. Two deep brown pools, hiding the pain that only barely escaped in hints of harsh and hungry days. Onesima folded leather hands in her purple apron on top of her more purple dress and struggled to keep her eyes open while her campesino husband told of reality on the parched land. Two deep brown pools caught the sunlight filtering through the thatch and searched the cluttered yard for memories of former times and days to come, all just the same when one is busy surviving. To be able to keep working when I'm old is my dream, she said quietly, knowing the necessity and not hoping for more. Oh, Onesima, my sister, we sit in your dusty, dirt-floored outdoor kitchen and eat your sweet oranges, sucking on your generosity and wondering about justice and hope. And so Elvia Alvarado and Onesima and those other sisters that you know and hear about and hopefully meet someday are part of the struggle that we must never forget as we work diligently for human rights and women's rights in the world. We'll talk a little bit about parenting is a partnership. I think that when we think of feminism and family ties, we think of how many women in families that have two spouses at home are struggling to know what's right and just in terms of the children and their own energies and enthusiasms and the spark that is within them that needs to grow. Some people have the luxury of having a spouse who shares the parenting so that both mother and father are working together to raise the children and both of them are following careers outside the home. And everyone is excited in that in those families, some of them we see models of that kind of family, and that's a neat situation when that happens. But it doesn't happen for everyone. There are tons of families that look different from that traditional family, no longer always the father that goes off to work and the mother that helps the children bake cookies and the white picket fence and the 2 1/3 children and the dog. But sometimes it's mother and father going off to work and taking turns so that each of them has time with the children, or sometimes it's mother and father going off to work and then the children going off to childcare. Sometimes families don't even look like that. Phyllis was telling me about a poster that she had seen that was a mother and 2 children sitting at table. And what I thought was so exciting about the poster was that it said across the top, "This family is not broken." So there are lots of families that don't look just like the families that we used to think. There's many, and many, many of the women that I work with at the Women's Resource Center at Cal Lutheran are single parents, struggling to work and get an education and eventually have a job that they will be able to continue to raise their family, and they're doing it alone. But when I say parenting is a partnership, I mean it's a partnership no matter what our families look like. It means that we need to be supporting each other and helping each other. We need to be fighting for and working toward quality child care in our communities in order that those single parents might have the opportunity of growing and learning and working, and their children might have the opportunity of growing and learning and being in a safe and well-run place. And that's part of our responsibility as global citizens and as local citizens to help make those things happen in our own communities. Not warehousing children, not just letting them be, but having quality child care. And that's one of the issues. I happen to be on a child care task force in the community of Thousand Oaks, and we're trying to work with the local businesses and the local college to train teachers and the businesses to help form and give benefits to their employees so that they can pay for quality child care. And some businesses and corporations are even starting to see the value of having child care right on the premises, so that their workers are better equipped to stay there and be content to be there where they don't have to worry about where their children are. So there's a lot of new patterns and things that are going on. One of the interesting patterns that I read about recently that I'm hoping to, I've talked to the dean about a long range dream for California Lutheran, is the idea of taking giving AFDC mothers a possibility of going to college. You know, the current situation with these work fair programs is such that if a woman is getting some kind of welfare aid, then she has to be working a certain time, and there's no time left to go to school. So women are, by those wonderful programs that we're trying to help, and really were set up by kind and caring people who wanted to be helpful, have trapped women in minimum wage situations for the rest of their life. And a very exciting college in Vermont called Goddard College got an idea that this didn't have to be, and they made an arrangement with the welfare system and the college and the mothers themselves who were interested in going back to school, and they take their AFDC payments and apply and get other government aid and apply those to board, room, and tuition for the mother and the children, and they go to college, and that they will continue in that kind of a relationship until the women graduate. They live in a house together on the campus of Goddard College and are with financial aid from the state and from their AFDC payments and everything, they're able to go to this school. And they come out then with a college education and are able to get out of that welfare trap. It just sounds like a really exciting program, and I'm hoping that that will happen more and more in areas all around the country. So when I say then that parenting is a partnership, it means that all of us as concerned people are helping in the care of the kids. I know our daughter has a little 2-year-old boy, and she's been teaching, and she said, you know, she teaches part-time. She shares a contract with another mother, and then they share the daycare situation too. And she said, you know, you're all for women working outside the home, and she said, I really enjoy that, but I also really remember back when you were at home with the kids, and she said, I kind of envy that possibility, and I think that the feminist movement has to look around and say that for women who choose to stay home with the children, if that's financially feasible, and for many it isn't, but if they choose to do that, we need to celebrate that as a wonderful part and a wonderful choice that people have. And that needs to be lifted up as an important choice for women. But not all women, especially single women or women whose husbands are perhaps out of work or are unable to, for some reason, support the family, don't have that choice. So together we need to think about new and creative ways for partnership. And then the last comment, the family reunions are required. This kind of is, it's a thought starter. I wanted to make it an appetizer for, I think sometimes of our four kids, they're all grown, and my parents have a family that centers in Lindsberg, Kansas, which is in the middle of the hottest state that I can imagine. And it's not the most exciting place to go in the middle of the summer. And last summer we had a family wedding there, and we kind of like put a lot of pressure on our kids to go there, partly because it was important to me that they know their roots. But it's not their favorite thing to do, and we had some quite interesting discussions about how we put pressures on older children. They're all in their late 20s and 30s. That's not what I'm talking about here when I say family reunions are quite required, although I think there is an advantage of in our country of trying to celebrate the familyness that might exist and to think about the roots from which you've come. But what I'm talking about here in family reunions are required is that we need to think of ourselves in all around the world as the family of God, and that we had best be about reunioning with our brothers and sisters. And that means perhaps our brothers and sisters in Central America, in China, in Israel and Lebanon. It might mean all of that, but not all of us are going to have the opportunity to go to all those places and find out all about that. It might mean having reunions with people in our own communities with whom we are alienated. It might mean getting around to deciding together how we can get together and talk about what it means to be the family of God. And I guess I wish I had a perfect ending to a discussion about that. I guess I would like to invite you to share some ideas that you might have about how we can do family reunions in our own life. How would you see yourselves? And I'm not talking about necessarily the old Midwestern style, or maybe it's back Eastern style too, of, you know, the park where they have the picnic shelter and people come, and some people spend weeks and months writing to relatives from all over, and they get 400 people together, and it's a really exciting thing, I guess, and there's a lot of emphasis on finding your roots and finding people. We got on the bus after we'd gotten off a plane from a trip recently, and there was a whole bunch of people, and they'd been to a family reunion. They all had t-shirts alike. I know when we had a family reunion when my parents were 50, we had made t-shirts for all of us, and we have this wonderful family picture, and all of us have the exact same t-shirt on. It says 50 years, cheers. And it was celebrating my folks. And I think those are wonderful things, but how are, besides those kind of traditional type family reunions, how are ways that we can think in terms of reunioning as the family of God?